All right, so good evening. Tonight's talk, and we're going to have a discussion, is on right effort. And I'm going to try to come in to this at a little different angle than you may have heard of it before. And sometimes my talks can be complex. Try to break it down, but you know, a lot of material. And tonight, I'm trying to make some very, hopefully at the end, clear points, and not that many, but I think this topic is a really interesting topic, and hopefully you'll agree by the time we get to the end of this. So what I want to do is start with a story that I know, I think at least two of you have heard, but even those of you who have heard it, it'll be in a completely different context, and then I'm going to pose a couple questions, and I want us to talk about the answers to the question, and then I'll give you some analysis. So I have this little grandson who's 3 years old, and he's crazy about trains and train crossings. So anything that has to do with trains, or, you know, like the up and down of train crossings, he's wild about it. You know, like if we're in the car and stop and, you know, Amtrak goes by, and he just, wow, it's the best. And he likes it so much that he has multiple sets of drumsticks where he imitates, you know, the going down, he says, you know, going up. So almost every Friday, we're together and spend the whole day together and part of the evening. And so I've taken him on all the trains. You know, like there's a train out in Davis, and there's a train in Old Town, and, you know, there's the Christmas train and the Halloween train and this train. And so we've done all of that. And I realized I've been riding Amtrak a lot to the Bay Area, and I realized I hadn't taken them on Amtrak. You know, so I thought, wow, that'll be a cool idea. You know, and there's an upstairs, right? And you get upstairs and see everything, and there's a little food car. You know, it's not very good, but, it's a little car. You know, he could go down, I could get him some pretzels. And so I thought, well, I'll just try it out and see if he likes it. So I got tickets to go from Sacramento to Davis and back. And I thought, well, if that goes well, okay, then maybe next time we'll go like to Berkeley, you know, and get off, and it stops, the Amtrak stops right there in that area where there's Spangers and a lot of nice little shops. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll go to that old diner there, that 50 diners, and take them to lunch and then get back on the train. So I get the tickets, and for those of you who haven't been to the Sacramento train station, it's quite old, and they're remodeling. It's really going to be nice when they finish. And it's a long walk from the station itself to where the trains are, and you go down under the tracks. So I wanted to get there early, make sure we get out there, and he could see, you know, look at the train. So we get there, and we walk out under the tunnel and everything. And yet, even though he's a pretty big little guy for 3 years old, he wanted to be carried part of the way. So, you know, I'm carrying, putting him down, and we get out to where the train is, and had about 10 minutes, so we were just hanging out with everybody, and, you know, he wanted to look at all the train, and, you know, there's all these things that, you know, you could turn on and off, which, of course, he wanted to do, and I kept him away from, but he was having a great old time. So we get on the train, go upstairs, and most of the seats are just regular passenger seats, and then periodically, maybe every 10 seats, there is a table with, you know, seats on both sides. So he wanted a big table, you know, to sit in. So we get in, and he's looking out the window and jumping all around and having a good old time, and the train kind of starts to move, and then it stops, you know. And I'm sitting there, and I look, and like if this is the aisle on the train, you know, I notice this guy coming towards me, and he's maybe 38 or 40, and in great shape, you know, not muscle bound, but just great shape, kind of a handsome guy, and he's got the gray T-shirt on, and he's got some kind of symbol, you know, here, and he walks up like if I'm sitting here and this is the table, he walks up like right here and he lifts up his t-shirt like this to show me a handgun. And he says to me, we've received a report that you may be kidnapping this child. And I'm here to investigate. So not your, like your everyday thing that happens, you know, occasionally happens. And, he's a little golden boy. He's got very dark skin like my daughter does. I told him who I was, you know, and who Koa was, and I opened up my phone and showed him all the pictures, you know, of all these different pictures of us, you know, and different things. And then I went to the index and showed him all of my daughter's information, you know, so he could see I wasn't trying to hide anything. And I said, why don't you just call my daughter, you know. So he asked me a number of questions, and then he said, well, I will call her, but the protocol is I can't call her in your presence. He says, he asked me a few more questions, and he was very good about it. I mean, he was really, given what he was there for, he's really good, you know. And so he starts, he says, I'm going to go call your daughter now. I'm going to go downstairs. He starts to walk away. He turns around and looks back at me and he says, but we're not going to allow the train to leave until I get your daughter on the phone. Yeah. So he goes downstairs and, you know, I don't know, kind of a little bit of time passes, you know. And I subsequently find out that he was able to get my daughter on the phone, and my daughter thought it was a joke.
Yeah,
and she thought that one of her friends was, you know, making her change. So at some point she realized that it wasn't a joke, and then she says, "No, that's my dad, you know, and that's my son, and they're supposed to be together and what have you." And he told her what he did not tell me was that the call that they received was that he and I didn't look alike. So it was clearly racial, you know. Because, you know, if anybody watched us out on the tracks, you know, we're touching each other and he's climbing all over me and, you know, we're having a good time. So, you know, when I heard that, one of my reactions was, you know, I guess this is what it feels like being black in America. Mm-hmm. This is what happens to a lot of black people, you know. And yeah. That doesn't happen to somebody who looks like me, you know. So they then let the train go, okay. And we go to Davis and have a great time in Davis. You know, the Davis train station has this old piano that's chained up to some pole out there that's all painted and everything, and boy, he just loved that. So, you know, we were playing on the piano for a long time, and we were only there for maybe 40 minutes, and then got on the train and came back, and then went home and cooked dinner. So, I want to start with this illustration in relationship to right effort. And you know, a right effort is one of the eight steps, planks, paths, parts of the Eightfold Path. And the reason that it's called right effort or right speech is that the Buddha said that there actually is a wrong Eightfold Path. So, I mean, that choice, and, you know, we talk about being skillful versus unskillful. You can use whatever language you want, but the message is that there are forms of conduct, meditation, concentration practices, view, that are wholesome and really nourishes, and those that aren't, you know, and knowing the difference between the two is pretty critical. It's the if you don't know the difference between the two, it's pretty hard to know if you're on the path or not. So I'd like to pose three questions, and then I'm going to turn the recorder off, and we'll talk about it a little bit, and then we'll come back. And the three questions are going to be, was the call to the Amtrak security officer right effort? And was the approach by the Amtrak security effort to me right effort? And then the third question is what would right effort look like in responding to this? Because although I described to you physically what I did, I didn't describe anything that I said or thought. So what would right effort look like if you were the person who had just been told, we're here to investigate the possibility that you're kidnapping a child? So I'm going to shut this off for a second. All right. So I want to analyze this situation a little bit from the perspective of right effort. And the first thing that these questions, in a way, were a little deceptive, and I wanted to see if anybody caught it. And one of you got really close to getting it. Okay. So there is a difference. There's Eightfold Path, right? Mm-hmm. That has these fundamental efforts, and it's important for all of us to understand these basic components, because it informs what we do with them. So there is a difference between right effort and right action. Okay, so this talk is on right effort, and the questions that I posed were, was there right effort in each of these three illustrations? And basically, most of the discussion was around right action. Okay? And so when you did the inner and the outer, this is the distinction between. So when I said tonight, that there's some fundamental points I want to make, this is really one of them, okay? And it informs a lot of how that the Eightfold Path is set up. So right action has to do with ethical conduct, non-harming, trying to bring compassion to what you do. Okay? So although there is an internal component to it, the Eightfold Path piece of right action is about what we do in the world. Okay? Right effort is what precedes right action. It is the internal piece. Okay, you with me? I'm going to talk a little bit about this. Okay. So traditionally, and as you know, there's many, many different ways to talk about this, and it's kind of like scholastically, if you can go in and read suttas and make it much more complex than I'm about to. But traditionally, we hear first, do no harm, which is restraint. Second, cultivate the good, which is in fact the development or cultivation of healthy, wholesome states of mind, viewpoints, what have you. So metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, generosity, forgiveness, beginning to understand the Buddhist idea of conditioned experience, of cause and effect based on conditions, and watching for that, which there was a lot going on here in this little incident, okay? the cultivation, and then the third is purify the mind, which is basically the element of observation and investigation that causes understanding and insight to arise. Okay, so traditionally, you can kind of take all of the other descriptions of types of actions, and there's a number of them, but they all funnel into one of those three things. Okay. So right effort is, for example, in this case, you know, you're just sitting here minding your own business and somebody asks you, well, actually tells you that there's a report that you specifically are a kidnapper, you know. So the what happens internally? How does one respond to that? And you could just hear from comments that one of the first and most important elements in this particular illustration, and actually, I think, until you're a pretty advanced person in terms of working with these, is the issue of restraint. You know, because in this circumstance and in other circumstances, what is the first thing that normally happens to all of us?
Take,
you know, we have an urge, an impulse, and even before there's a thought, you know, there's this urge to do something, or this urge to, you know, to recoil, and, you know, and then if we don't see that and don't understand it, we immediately act on it. Hmm. You just think of, like, right speech. I mean, how often do, you know, we just fire, you know, in a situation. So the first part of right effort is the ability to see a situation and exercise restraint so that you don't act too quickly and don't hurt yourself or hurt another person or point your mind in an unwholesome direction. Okay, so does that work? Okay, and that's all internal. It's all back here before I do or say anything to Mr. Amtrak Security. Okay. So then the second element is cultivation. Okay, so in any given situation, what am I trying to cultivate as a person who believes that they're a Buddhist practitioner? And, you know, what I'm trying to cultivate are many of the things that I'm in. I'm trying to be kind. I'm trying to act from a place of balance. I'm trying to engage in right and thoughtful speech that promotes a good result, as opposed to just like defending myself. Okay. So the whole cultivation piece we can take there are many, many different ways. You know, for me, one of them is just actually seeing what I'm experiencing and understanding it. You know. And in fact, before restraint, before cultivation, before purifying the mind, in my opinion, the single most important part of right effort is not doing anything at all. It's what we, the baseline of what we're trying to learn in our meditation practice, of just staying present with whatever is there and not trying to modify it, change it, or alter it. Just learning how to be with a strong emotion, with a discomfort, with an ambiguity, with confusion, and just stay there and keep watching it. And, you know, in the Satipatthana Sutra, you know, the sutta, the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha said there's three things that we're trying to do when we do that. When we just try to stay, we're trying to understand it, and understand it in the sense of seeing how mind states arise, seeing why they are sustained and why they disappear, so that in any given moment you can start to see that and then adjust internally your experience accordingly so you can be skillful. Okay? And then the third element of purifying the mind is really what I just described. You know, the end game. You know, there's all these fantastic parts of a good meditation practice. You know, it's stabilizing, it's calm, it provides you with, you know, a healthy emotional structure, on and on and on. But in the end, the purpose of this meditation practice is liberating insight, that you see deeply into your mind states, how they arise, how they cause you to hurt yourself, how they cause you to hurt other people, and then learn how to basically restructure these deep fundamental habits of mind. Okay? So that's basically right effort. Right action is the product of right effort. If we've got our game together on right effort, our conduct, right speech, another element, right? You know, if you think of the five precepts, all these. If we have right effort together, the right action actually becomes pretty easy. Because we're not flying off the handle, we're not just acting on an impulse. There's some process, a thoughtful, mindful process that's going on, right? Before we launch whatever that is. And we're cultivating the states of mind that actually create a new baseline for how we react. That's the purpose of practice. So our baseline for getting reactive gets higher. There has to be more challenge to get reactive compared to when we first started practicing, And we start defaulting towards kindness and compassion, where before we defaulted towards anger and fear or anxiety. Okay. Is all this kind of working? Okay. So the first big takeaway for me on this is the difference between right effort and right action. Okay. And so in terms of like looking at our own conduct or any situation, there are these two components, and it's easy to kind of get confused. And what you're looking at, those are two really different ways of analyzing a situation. Because one's external and one is internal. Okay? And why it's so important, if we can, to take a breath and ask a question before we decide or make an assumption, goes to the issue of right effort and the person that you're with. Is their effort right effort or not? And so this also for me shows how the elements of the Eightfold Path are completely unified. So we know that our intention is the main driver in terms of an assessment of the karmic impact or value of any action. The karmic being which way is our mind being pointed in any given moment. We're either cultivating a positive, skillful, healthy mind state and habit, or we're reinforcing a pre-existing negative one. Okay? So intention is the driver. So right effort is driven by right intention. That's always provocative for me. Because, I say to myself, well, how often do I actually reflect on what my intention is in this situation? And then I see I go into situations and I actually have mixed intentions. And if I had just taken a couple of minutes just to be quiet, and think I would realize that and then set an intention to go in with a particular intention. But if I don't do that, and I'm unclear about my intention, or if I have mixed intentions, you go in there and then it gets all jumbled up and you're confused and you screw everything up. Okay, so intention. So in the moment, another element of the Eightfold Path is mindfulness, right? Global, pervasive self-awareness of what's happening in your body and your mind. Okay, so like in this instance in particular, having at least some awareness of that would be pretty darn critical, because it could be very easy in that. In just the set of facts that I gave, for somebody to be pretty frightened or pretty upset or pretty angry and disconnected from that, just kind of lost in it, identified with it, and then, who knows what goes down, right? So without mindfulness, that whole piece is missing, right? And then right view, which has to do with understanding motivation and Buddhist causation and how mind states arise and this guy's intention based on his conduct. That has to be part of the mix as well, right? So already we've got five or six of the Eightfold Path, right? You take any one of those out and it's not going to work right. So I think this is a great illustration of we tend to, it's easy to think that the Eightfold Path is, well, you know, I'll work on right speech, okay? As if that's disconnected from right effort and right intention and mindfulness. It's not. You can't do right speech without those, at least from a Buddhist perspective. You could set up a bunch of rigid guidelines, you know, like, I'm not going to say X. Okay? But that's not what this is about. What this is about is developing this really gorgeous form of self-awareness and making skillful choices. Okay? And then the final thing that it includes that for some reason, I don't know why you don't hear more talks about this. Or at least I don't. And I don't see articles written about it either. And I don't understand that. And that is the concept of clear comprehension. Clear comprehension is the second element in the Satipatthana Sutra. And for purposes of this discussion tonight, it's basically making an assessment of the consequences of what you're about to do before you do it, so that there is actually either an intuitive or a cognitive, and usually both of those, assessment of like, well, where is this situation going? And of this mix of things, how do I actually stay conscious? How do I stay here in myself and as equanimous as I can be and make a right decision? And then that decision, what may be the consequences of that decision? You know, I mean, it's as simple as, you know, you think you're trying to diffuse the tension and try to make a joke out of what this guy said, and, you know, he doesn't think it's funny at all, right? You know? You know, you get a little confrontational because you feel righteous, and then where does that go? You know? So this is all about skillful action. So for me, this is how it's kind of a wonderful illustration of how all these pieces fit together. And then the final element is the Buddha said that there is one element that we haven't spoken of, and it's not part of the Eightfold Path. It's a quality of mind. He says it is absolutely essential to right effort. You know, that if you don't have this element, it's hard to have right effort. And does anybody have a guess of what that might be?
Loving kindness?
No, but that's certainly a floor. You know,
A trained mind.
That would be important, but it's not the particular one that he said. Yeah.
Is it calmness?
Say it again.
Just being calm.
That's close. Okay. That's really close. Okay.
I don't know the word for it, but I'm thinking sort of motivation or just a desire or drive to understand all this and care enough to actually examine so closely and arrive at right effort.
Yeah, that would be the way I would classify that is right intention and right view. That you really have this deep intention to understand how mind states arise and sustain, and that turns into right view and to insight. Liberating insight. Okay, so what I'm looking for is
stability of mind.
No, what I'm looking for is the Buddha said, in order to have true right effort, you have to have enduring patience.
Yes.
So I mean, you know, we're always thinking of all, you know, metta, compassion, you know, and it's like, oh, well, yeah, of course you have to be patient, you know, but he said, no, foundationally, a characteristic of right effort is enduring patience. And the story that is frequently told, and you know, you can decide whether you want to believe this literally or it's a teaching story, but it's the story of the monk Sumedha, the monk Sumedha was eons before there was this particular historical Buddha, 2,500 years ago. Eons before there was this man at that time named Sumedha, and he lived in a village in India. And the word was he heard that an awakened being, was coming to the village. A Buddha. He's there's the Buddha, and then there's Buddha. It's Buddha means awake. So for some reason, he was just captured by this idea. He wasn't particularly spiritual or religious or anything else, but he heard about this, and so he's waiting, and he's seeing the excitement. It's like the village is really getting excited, and they're all making garlands, and so the awakened being shows up, and everybody's throwing garlands and flowers on the streets and everything, and he's standing there watching him, and then this person is there for several days, and he just follows him around, and he's just this is the modern version of the story. He's just blown away. That's not the way they described it in the sutta, but he's just blown away by this person. He can't believe their presence and just the aura that he has about him, kindness and compassion, and he watches how he treats people and listens to the things that he says, and spontaneously he makes a deep vow that what he wants is to have the qualities that he sees in this person, that's who he wants to become. He wants to become an awakened being, and that he makes the commitment, and it's however long it takes, he will practice until that happens. So the story goes that eons and eons later, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, Sumedha is going through these different lives and practicing, and then he is born. And he is born as the person that we know to be the historical Buddha. Mm. Okay. So that is the story about enduring patience. And not just perseverance, but enduring patience, like eons and eons and eons. So, yes, Brian.
I was going to share you and you're walking in the door, and I said, Buddha light. My comment was in reference to, right effort. And what I got out of what your fact pattern was is that you had your contact with whoever on the train, but then it appeared to me like you had continual right effort to go down the track to Davis, and you had right effort to engage the piano and all that, and to get back on the train. And my comment was in reference to, I think I would have, my right effort, I might have gotten through that incident, but then my mind would have taken over and would have started playing.
Yeah.
And so it seemed like you have to re-engage that right effort to ensure you're okay, but also Koa. Mm-hmm. If he's still doing this train thing today, then I would assume he's not traumatized too much by trains now, but that's what my Buddha-like comment was like, is that you and your grandson were able to go and enjoy the piano, or I'm not sure I could have done that. I would have been so wrapped up in getting through the event that I would have lost sight of the piano or whatever.
Yeah, and all of us have got an experience that we find, traumatic in some way. And we're so angry, or we're so shocked, or what have you, and the momentum just keeps going.
Right. Afterwards is often harder. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
Because that's when the mind starts kicking in and turning.
Yeah, and you start ruminating about it and what have you. So I'm just going to take 2 minutes, and I'm going to tell you what my reaction was to all of this.
Enduring patience.
So. So I recognize that this is a topic, particularly with a small child, where there can be a lot of strong emotions and differing opinions, But my daughter said to me, after the train started, I called her, and she said to me, Wow, that was, you know, that was something. And the other thing, you know, it, because it was in the afternoon, maybe it was like 12:10 or 12:20, there weren't like a lot of people on the train. But in the section where I was, there were a number of people. And two guys in maybe their 40s, after this went down, got up and came over to me and basically said, "Wow, man, that was like really intense." You know, and like wanted to talk with me. I mean, they were traumatized by it, you know, just watching it. It is amazing, you know, and they were like trying to comfort me, you know, which I've never had strange men get up out of their seats and try to comfort me. I mean, that's the first time that's happened. It was actually very nice. My daughter was surprisingly lighthearted about it. And I think why she was she said, you know, yeah, crazy, and I am so happy that this guy, right, she's not talking about the person who called, but erred on behalf of COA's benefit. Mm-hmm. That was her perspective. Like if something actually had been happening to her child, you know, that somebody would do that. And actually, I that's my end point. You know, I feel like if a call came in about this, that it's almost a given our culture right now for them to ignore that.
Yeah.
And it turns out that it's true. You know, somebody says, "Well, that's not very real." Man, I mean, you can hear it, right? I mean, it's 6 o'clock news. No. That guy's going to be roasted. So I really find on all of this, I think that the person who reported it probably had some kind of traumatic experience of some kind. I can understand that. And this guy, I didn't express this earlier, but this guy could not have been more professional. I mean, for a guy his age, I mean, it was a class act the way he handled it. And, you know, I think quite quickly recognized that I wasn't a kidnapper, you know. And this is an interesting piece because I feel like he apologized to me. But I don't know if he did. I mean, I don't have a recollection of him saying, "Gee, I'm sorry that I have to do this." But I have a very strong emotional feeling that's how he felt, you know, in the context of your professional conduct. So, I'm sincere that, like, I want to see if I can meet him and talk with him about that. Like, you know, and like these questions, like what was running through his mind and all of that. It was so outside of the box for me. You know, I had said earlier, like if somebody had come up and said, and mentioned a friend of mine's name and said, you know, "We just got a telephone call that, you know, your friend so-and-so, that you said some disrespectful things to him or something." I mean, I'd probably get defensive, you know, like somebody accusing you. But this was like, you know, it was like, it's so far out of the box. I didn't get offended, and I didn't get defensive either. Retrospectively, it's interesting because I don't think I was like in shock. You know, I really tried to look at this. I don't think I was in shock, and I realized that this was like a horrendous allegation, and that this guy was here and trying to do a job, and you know. He had a handgun, and I had to be very, very thoughtful and respond in a skillful way, you know. And I think I did, you know. I talked to him, and I think the way I responded was a huge part in his reaction, because I think he saw immediately I was not defensive at all, and I wasn't getting upset either, you know. And then it seemed like it was over pretty quickly. You know, it's not like it took a long time. And he left, and then I kind of checked COA out and talked to him. And, you know, he I don't know what he saw, because like when he showed the gun, I was looking at him, right? I wasn't looking. I think Koa was still looking out the window. And I'm sure that he felt the tension in the air, you know, sure of that. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, you know, I got him and put him in my lap and we talked, and he seemed like he rebounded pretty quickly. And then we had a great time, you know, I mean, on the ride and the rest of the day. It's just a provocative experience. But I, like you were saying afterwards, interestingly, I didn't go into a bunch of rumination. And I think part of the reason is that I think that mindfulness saves you. Mm-hmm. I think mindfulness spontaneously comes to your aid. And I believe that that's what happened. I mean, like, when this happened, I didn't check out. I didn't get any, I was 100% there. I knew what I was feeling, and I think I acted skillfully, so I didn't have any reason to ruminate. Mm. You know, I wasn't saying to myself, geez, I wish I would have said X, or, you know, I wish, you know, or, I had none of that. I mean, it's really surprising a little bit, you know, at some level. So I personally felt really, really good about it, you know. And to the degree that there was some impact on Koa, I feel that my ability for these things not to happen must have helped him. Because if after it was over, I was ruminating and getting upset and what he would feel that, and he would be, you know, intuitively saying, geez, I wonder why Poppy's upset with me, or I wonder what's going on, you know. Well, none of that happened. We're going to wrap up, and I'd like to say many of us know, almost everybody knows, that our good friend Victor Flaming and his family is having a very difficult time. Roseanne, his wife, has finally entered what appears to be the final stages of her fight with cancer and is dying. So I would like to dedicate our efforts tonight to explore this issue in a healthy way, and to, you know, learn how to point our minds in the right direction. Whatever merit comes out of that, I'd like to dedicate to them, these two lovely people who are in need at the moment. And may the two of them and all of us and every little child that has been kidnapped, or somebody believes has been kidnapped, and everybody else in the world who is suffering, may all of us be free from suffering. Mm-hmm.